Well, let's start.
In this series, we're going to discuss Michelangelo through the lens of sex, death, and God.
And we're moving on to part three. So,
which, to be honest, is the death and God part.
If you haven't guessed already, you're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities with Luke Jones.
And George Gingell.
And we're in the concluding part of our discussion of the work of Michelangelo Buonarroti. Michelangelo's extremely long career meant that he was old for a very long time. And it seems that thoughts of mortality in the afterlife hang over quite a long period of his late work. The reconstruction of Basilica of St. Peter, the centre of Western Christianity, was a project that had been under consideration more or less continuously since the return of the popes from Avignon in the previous century. It had been going on for pretty much the entirety of Michelangelo's adult life in different forms. There were schemes involving extending the church while retaining most of the existing fabric. And then latterly, well, I mean, not that latterly, when he was probably in his 30s, so in the early 16th century, a decision was made to reconstruct it more or less entirely to the plans of Donato Bramante, with work commencing in 1506, at which time Michelangelo was in his early 30s, sort of around the time that he'd just finished the David. It was taken forward by a whole series of architects, and 40 years later, Michelangelo himself was appointed in 1546, at which point he was already 70 years old.
And he would continue to be head of the construction of it for nearly another 20 years.
And be, I would say, by far the most influential person on its eventual design.
Yeah. I would say the most influential is Bramante, but he's the linchpin of the middle. And in fact, the construction of it would go on. I mean, again, you could say, in a sense, it's finished under Mussolini, if you wanted to, but really finished in the 18th century.
So it's a project, yeah, it's basically a 200-year project. One thing that which we forgot to mention at all in the last episode is the Reformation. But yeah. St. Peter's is actually has this very strong connection to the schism in Western Christianity during the 16th century and the emergence of Protestantism. In part because, along with the with this famous like large debt to the Fugger banking family, of it's one of the two reasons why indulgences are being sold in such large numbers in the area of Germany where Martin Luther was.
And then after the Reformation, the building itself becomes part of the early response. Yeah. This, from its outset, was to be a church like no other, and it still is. I think there are now competitors in terms of literal scale, but I think there is no church in the world that competes, even competes in grandeur.
Let's start, let's do the kind of the long durée kind of history.
Yeah.
So I think the key event...
If you cast your minds back to the high summer of 406.
I think we can skip forward a bit, but during kind of late medieval period, there'd been this schism in the church between two competing popes, one in Avignon and one in Rome, and the popes had ended up really in Avignon until the kind of start of the 15th century.
Well, I mean, there really are competing popes. I wouldn't knock off the one in Rome or even the one in Pisa, and there is somewhat of a dilution effect, and papal states in Rome fall into quite a bad state of dereliction.
Yes, it was said that when the schism had been ended and the papacy had returned to Rome, that there were wolves living in the Basilica of St. Peter, which at this point is a church which really does literally stretch back to the age of Constantine, the 4th century.
It's a huge basilica. Also is then way outside Rome, in terms of the inhabitants. I mean, it's well within the city walls. Rome has got the old Roman city walls, which encompass a massive area.
Yeah.
But the town inside the middle was really a... I think probably when they moved back, there were a few thousand people living there in basically ruins. And one of those ruins was the basilica. So the core of the building, which is basically a rectangular shed...
Of vast dimensions.
Of vast dimensions, with a big rectangular courtyard in front of it, two rows of columns, an end, and a huge incrustation of semi-derelict chapels, sculptures.
The tombs of
shrines,
all of the early popes.
The early popes, the tomb of St. Peter, a kind of warren of tunnels underneath it, encrusted in the mosaic that, if people have been to Constantinople or, I mean, I should say Istanbul, I suppose. We are in the 21st century. Istanbul or Ravenna. Yeah. It's got lots of that stuff. Yeah. And it's really been through many phases of dereliction. And the repair works on it since then have really been patchworks.
The reason why people start thinking of doing some significant works to alter it are that there are inherent problems with preserving how it is in that form, which is that it's got like a big open wood roof, which is falling in, crossing this enormous big nave. And it's literally a question of getting timbers which are big enough to repair it in some ways.
Yeah, it was built by the Roman Emperor. He could get things done. The Pope's powerful, but he's not that powerful. So there are proposals to... It's a bit like St. Paul's, actually, if people know the history of that. There are proposals to patch it up, and there's various work done to patch up the old one.
The less drastic proposals would have been to perhaps vault over the nave so that it wouldn't be dependent on this wood roof anymore. Also to make it more like a medieval cathedral by extending beyond the apse at the end to create like a choir and a longer bit and a proper crossing. And actually some of those things are attempted in a very piecemeal way, a tiny bit. But as we've noted in previous episodes, it's an era when, although the papacy has kind of been reunified, standards of good governance do not exactly reign.
It varies. There's occasionally a pope who'll be around for a few years who will get some stuff done.
Yeah.
And then a Borgia will come in and bugger everything up for another.
You'll have an interlude. There's lots of orgies.
There's a good in our time where it goes something like this. Well, I suppose it wasn't really like the Mafia. And then in the next 5 minutes, they go on to describe like performance sex parties in the papal palace and a spate of poisonings.
Yeah. So that it meant that no one was very good at getting anything done. And, you know, we've already encountered the figure of Pope Julius, who made the decision once and for all that actually they were just going to build the whole thing again. And the architect he appoints is really the foremost architect of that period, Donato Bramante.
And is one of the founders of Western architecture. Yeah. So Bramante had started working in... I mean, he was a painter. He'd worked around northern Italy. He'd gone to Milan, where he had transitioned out of painting into architecture via architectural paintings.
He was a much better architect than painter, quite bad.
They show strength of character. But yeah, that's strange. Along the way, he sort of invents classicism as we know it. So before, you know, you can think of the architects of the early Renaissance.
Who had rediscovered, as they saw it, the classical language.
But it's that's a period, and he's the one who brings us into stone columns on the outsides of buildings. I mean, what would the tropes be? Like stone buildings, big columns.
It's a kind of an approach which is applicable to new types of buildings in which innovation can take place, not just in the arrangement of...
I nearly said, it's very 21st century, by which I meant it's very 15th century.
So should we talk about the Tempietto, which is this tiny little shrine built to mark what was thought to be the site of the crucifixion of St. Peter. It's in the courtyard of the church of San Pietro in Montorio, I think it is, which is up on one of the hills.
It's a tiny project that includes aspects of almost every facet of architecture. Yeah. In a sense, it's an urban space. It's got the courtyard and the relationship of the courtyard and the building are crucial.
It draws clearly on the example of circular classical temple plans, yeah, which were a thing.
There's one in Rome, but there's a better one in Tivoli. It's got a cement roof in a dome, and it's the first cement dome since antiquity. Not quite concrete yet. Yeah. And it's tiny, but is recognisably classical.
And it's got these little separate columns all the way around the outside. And it's also got these engaged pilasters, which go all the way around the inside, and which are then actually not replicated on the interior. It's slightly different on the inside of the... What's kind of interesting is that he... This is something he kind of picks up along the way, but which ends up being incredibly...
Yeah, he's like in, you know, I was talking about epochal events in the first episode. He's kind of an epochal event in architecture, actually. I think, obviously, you know, when you zoom out in time, things like the Renaissance or Classicism are obvious. And as soon as you delve in, they disappear like morning mist. But if you want to have someone who founds architecture, I think he's the nearest thing.
And he has various other things. I mean, he's someone who, I think... Like Brunelleschi, was very interested in proportional relationships, and who I think architecture is extremely studied in the mathematical relationship of the different parts in a way which is quite different from what Michelangelo would do.
Yes, and although like Michelangelo, he has probably better than Brunelleschi a fantastic understanding of three-dimensional form.
Yeah,
but like Brunelleschi, he is a terrific close examiner of Roman ruins and Roman architecture. And the thing about him is that he gets this job, which makes sense, and then he does the sensible thing, which is he hires about 20 people to help him with it. With one exception, none of them have any architectural experience, but they're great architects, and they include Raphael.
Yeah.
Famous. Peruzzi.
Yep.
Goes on to be a great architect. Giulio Romano.
Yeah.
Builds many of the famous buildings in Mantua. The architect is Antonio da Sangallo, yeah. Who all these old books will say Sangallo very unhelpfully, but I think I found five members of this family.
Yeah, they're a dynasty.
Who do buildings?
Yeah.
It's kind of like Gilbert Scott, yeah. In the UK. There's loads of them, yeah. And they've been going for 100 years by this point.
Yeah,
and he's like maybe the first professional architect in the sense that he didn't do anything else.
Yeah.
And there are a number of other people, and together they make an architectural office, and Bramanti kind of teaches them, this is how you do architectural drawing, we're going to work together, yeah. They get, you know, divvies up, and he makes what is almost the first architectural office with these guys, I think you could kind of say that, and they together work through the first stage of the building, and then when Bramanti dies, various other people from this office take it over and push it right through until they're all dead.
Yeah.
And then Michelangelo takes over.
What should be said is that so there's an initial period of activity under Bramante, but it gradually peters out. When Sangallo is appointed, the project has been in a bit of a hiatus for quite a long time. So let's try and describe should we describe first Bramante's design and then what was done during his period? Because it starts to establish where the project is at when Michelangelo takes it over.
So the first design's amazing.
Yeah, so Bramante's initial design, the best representation of it which survives is actually on a commemorative medal, which is quite sweet. But you can make quite a lot out about what it was meant to be like. There's this enormous, colossal dome up on top. The project is perfectly kind of symmetrical on two axes. So there's a huge central dome, and then surrounding that there are four littler domes, and then in between the corners of all of those are four yet littler domes. And then coming even further out, there are these little side chapels, which are littler domes again. It's almost kind of fractal in a way.
It's a sort of fusion of... The middle dome is very, very like the Pantheon.
Yes.
It's to be made of concrete, which he doesn't quite know how to do, yeah. And to be exactly like the Pantheon. And then the pattern of the other domes is like Hagia Sophia.
Yeah, so these kind of cascading down,
you know,
set
of smaller and smaller domes. And it's a central plan, which is something people have been trying out for 100 years or so, you know, with mixed success.
And the work that was done during his time is that they do demolish some of the crossing of Old St. Peter's, and they build the piers, which are the sort of four central bits around this central crossing.
Well, they build the foundations for them.
The foundations of them.
They start getting up.
They start getting up, but it's described that they also build these very thin parts of some of the big arches are built. It's thought that they're not strong enough. It seems reasonable to think that they really weren't strong enough, although given that the works are also semi-abandoned, you could possibly give him the benefit of the doubt about this. But there are
it's
these
also
kind
worth
of
saying the way you build domed and arched roofs is you start with the seam, and you only build the seam, and then you expand out from that.
Yeah, but really they don't manage to expand out very far. And what happens in the period
worth mentioning? These are huge. It's huge. Yeah. Huge. It's really big. Biggest building project in the world at this time.
Yeah. So, in the period between Bramante's death and Michelangelo picking up the torch, which is 32 years, there's this whole sequence of succeeding designs which the project goes through. And this is actually like a very iconic kind of architecture history slide, which if you've done a kind of architecture history survey course in your education at any point, you've probably seen, but the succeeding plans for St. Peter's, starting with Bramante's and going through all of the others,
Before you talk about them, can I put an asterisk, which is that I think there's a problem here, which is like a classic problem in biology, which is that we have five fossils and we've put them in a nice line. Actually, I suspect there was a huge amount of arguing, and many different designs were sketched out, drawn out, and configured that we just don't have any record of. And I think some of the arguments, like the central plan versus the long plan, actually, I think probably went back and forward several times, and it's all a process of design during construction.
So this book, the Keith Miller's book on St. Peter's, which has a bit of a discussion of we don't really know, but people hypothesize that there may have been attempts to save part or all of the nave of Old St. Peter's and to join it on in some way to the new centrally planned church which was going to be built, and that because of its extreme antiquity and because of all of the things which were contained in it, and because of, you know, there was a clear value in keeping it.
For example, it includes the tomb of St. Peter, founder of the church, keeper to the keys of heaven.
Which is kind of important, yeah. Well, the evolution of the plan is like this. So you start off with this. The Bramante plan is symmetrical, and it kind of dissolves away at the edges through these smaller and smaller domes, so that it has something like 8 different entrances. It has all of these little chapels petering away. Someone should build it. But the thing is,
stop building like giant mock pantheons in Tennessee. I want.
Well, you could do this with reinforced concrete. Now, one of the things is that all of the structural members are relatively small compared with the succeeding versions of the church, and actually, this is probably one of the reasons why it started to become problematic and couldn't be made. In the succeeding designs by Peruzzi, Sangallo,
and Raphael.
Well, Raphael's one is shown as this option which attempts to incorporate the old nave, which I think is a very interesting kind of what could have been scenario. In the Peruzzi and Sangallo options, the structure gets bigger. So the piers and the supporting areas get, the kind of dark areas get larger and larger in order to support the colossal mass of this suspended dome and masonry. But what they retain is this profusion of little side chapels and ambulatories and aisles, which all kind of bleed out around the edges and which create all of these ancillary spaces around the kind of central mass of the cathedral. In this way, they have much more in common with older churches. This is typically the way in which all old churches and cathedrals were made, that you have this kind of tiered structure in which you have sort of side chapels and you have aisles and then you have the nave. And there's a good structural reason for this, which is that everything kind of works to buttress the enormously tall central part.
But also, I think there's good liturgical through the whole of this series. I think we've like missed out discussing the effects of architecture on liturgy, which I think is probably reasonable given our presumed listenership. But the nature of worship was changing at this time from one in which lots of people would pray at shrines and in which the business of prayer was quite professionalized. Old St. Peter's had loads of shrines, the purpose of which were often to pray for, either for supplicants to pray to saints for intercession, or for priests to pray to intercede on behalf of notables. And it's a different sort of relationship to the one which becomes increasingly important, which is the Protestant-inspired, but the idea was going around before the Protestant Reformation, that actually the community of people together creates worship. Yeah. And if you want a sort of earlier sense, if you go to Orthodox Christian services, you know, Easter, it's going on all day. Yeah. You have a kind of tag team of priests. People come in and go out. People pray to saints. People receive the sacrament in a rather different way. There's less of an interest in some, you know, the doctrine is different. You know, there's more of a kind of focus on key bits of, you know, very much more edited kind of canon. And that's beginning to change.
Right. Let me just finish off on these plans. So the, if you were going to simplify the sort of the process of transformation, you gradually go from, gradually this sort of diffuse plan starts to coagulate and thicken around the centre. It becomes bigger and bigger. But up until Michelangelo...
Particularly the four piers.
Yeah.
Which, the four crossing piers, which just get huge.
But they retain this kind of concentricity, these radiating outside smaller bits, until Michelangelo's. And Michelangelo's plan is initially, it's strange because it looks smaller than any of the others. It's shrunk into itself, but the one of the paradoxes of his design is that he makes it smaller in order to make it bigger. One of the things which he has done is to eliminate entirely this kind of outer concentric ring of little chapels. And what this means is that when you encounter the mass of St. Peter's, it immediately goes from ground level up, like four stories, wham, straight up to its full height. And so it's this cliff face-like wall of the church is the outer wall of it. It's immediately vast and enormous.
Yeah, so instead of the boundary dissolving, it is concentrated. Yeah. Instead of the energy of the space diffusing, it is propelled upwards. Bigness.
It's monolithic was the thing which I wanted to say.
Yeah, it's monolithic. And but there is a massive difference to what we've got now, which is that it still has a central plan.
Yeah, so one of the, we also see there's a whole series of later interventions, and one of the things is that it eventually grows a nave again after the old nave has been demolished.
So in a sense, if you want to see what Michelangelo's is like, if you can, when it's rather difficult, get behind the back is what St. Peter's would have been like, which has got his ornamental expressive scheme, the strange shapes that he creates, because in a sense, there is still a bit of the ghosts of the domes, which exist in the fact that the perimeter, the curtilage, is a complex series of points and curves and arcs.
Yeah.
It creates this very interesting perimeter wall, but as you say, it goes up in one flight.
Yeah, so it curves outwards at each of the points of the cross, as it were, the kind of the cross of the plan. It's as if the whole ground plan has been drawn and then extruded straight up. And the outside has this order of pilasters, which are enormous and which are also smeared onto the outside of this curved form. So they bend and fold with it.
And it's got all his classic jazzy reinterpretation of motifs. And it's got his classic banding.
It's very good. It's very strong. It's all in this wonderful travertine, which I think is really the best stone for this kind of carving.
Which actually we should have said in the Capitoline. Yeah. It's cut in this fantastic stone, which has got a very fine
kind of slightly textured.
Yeah, yeah, like 10% mid-bed Portland or something. Which just holds light with a real terrific intensity.
Yeah.
Such a beautiful stone.
Yeah, amazing. And the pilasters are, feels like they're about 2 meters wide, way more long, larger.
Maybe bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, they're huge. The whole thing is huge. Everything is so big.
You're really given this sense like you're approaching the doorway to the kingdom of God, you know? Everything has become entirely, like, completely inhuman in its massiveness.
Yeah, when you're walking up the courtyard in the middle, it does seem to be nearer.
Do you want the quotation about San Gallo's design?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. San Gallo's design, I think it's worth saying that of all the people who worked on it, he was the weakest. Yeah, the plan is kind of much better than the elevation. The elevation is quite constipated.
Quite a lot of Michelangelo's letters are preserved. I'm not sure you get his genuine voice, but I think you get like a little taste of it in some of these places. And his letter about San Gallo is rather funny for its bitchiness.
It's worth noting that the reason he hadn't got the job because Bramante was judged to be more competent. Michelangelo can never work with anyone else. So when Michelangelo's on it, he's on his lonesome. Bramante had like 20 chums. And they all got on well with him, and he was training them up.
But by the time he'd taken it over, because Bramante, who I think he really loathed when he was alive, 30 years after his death, he's able to regard with a certain fondness. Messer Bartolomeo, dear friend, it cannot be denied that Bramante was a skillful architect, and the equal of anyone from the time of the ancients until now. It was he who drew up the original plan of St. Peter's, not full of confusion, but clear and straightforward, with ample light, and detached from the surrounding buildings so that it did not in any way interfere with the palace. It was considered to be a fine design, and there is still evidence that it was so. Indeed, every architect who has departed from Bramante's plan, as San Gallo has done, has departed from the right way. And that this is true may be seen by anyone who looks at his model with unprejudiced eyes. In the first place, the outer ring of chapels he shows will exclude all the light provided by Bramante in his plan. And not only this, but he has not provided any fresh means of lighting, while there are so many gloomy lurking holes, both above and below, that any sort of knavery could easily be practised. Such as the hiding of banished persons, the coining of false money, the rape of nuns, and other misdemeanours. And when, at night, the time comes for shutting up the church, it would require 25 men to make sure that no person remained there in hiding. And it would be sufficiently difficult to find them. Furthermore, there would be this other drawback that in adding this circular work to the outside of Bramante's plan, it would be necessary to pull down the Pauline Chapel, the offices of the Piombo, the Ruota, and many other buildings. I do not think that even the Sistine Chapel would remain intact.
And so, when Michelangelo got hold of the project, he demolished everything San Gallo had built.
Yeah, one of the controversial things he does, not for the first time, is to demolish really large amounts of the works already completed. Which I think would have made everyone quite nervous, given that, like, he's in his 70s at this point. Yeah. They think he's going to die any minute. And actually, I mean, one of the things, this remains a conversation going on, even as the works start to advance and to progress. They really want to make sure they know how they're going to do the dome before he dies.
They're asking him, you've got to give us all the drawings, you've got to give us plans, you've got to tell us how to do it, because you're going to die. And actually, he does provide them with quite a lot of drawings. And for quite a long time, there's quite a lot of earnestness about carrying them out to the letter, which he demanded. He's got that slight Rorkian, you must do exactly, having, you know, messed with everyone else's ideas, you must do exactly as I say.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ammanati, who's writing to here, is actually the person who took on, who was responsible for interpreting quite a lot of this stuff.
It was also under him that the last bits of, he was like demolisher in chief. Yeah. He demolished the old bits of St. Peter's as well. And
I think this is a project where you can see the design process, in particular the kind of modelling process, very clearly.
So something that we've mentioned sort of in passing is that he would work in several ways. Clay.
Yeah.
He would sketch without scale often and perspective. In the Farnese Palace, he is known to have had large sections of what was going to be stonework roughed out in wood and then put in place so he could look at them. And so you can see that he's working with the physicality of material.
Yeah.
And there's a huge model. Quite often what he does is he is developing the things that he's interested in models that he makes himself. And then when he's bored and he knows something's got to be done to demonstrate to the client, he pays someone else to make a model, which inevitably he doesn't like.
Yeah, the models in wood, the standard kind of presentation model, and actually also the working set of construction information, are these big scale wooden models. But Michelangelo didn't make those, although everything else he did himself, but he palmed those off on somebody else. He didn't like it.
He's got no working patience. he can't bear to do anything that isn't just to do with his creative process.
I think the badge for this episode, we're going to use this this kooky painting, actually painted about 100 years after his death, of him presenting the big wooden model to the Pope.
It's probably a 6.5 out of 10 as a painting.
It's quite bad, yeah. It's one of those, I think it's by like a distant relative, and largely the way in which the columns fold around and about the curving and kind of bending surface of the cliff-like exterior is a very clear justification of the clay modelling process, because it's very difficult to see how else you would arrive at something like that without the ability to kind of fold and distort things.
It's something that he had by this point developed the skills for. There is an evolution towards beginning to think about things as more than surfaces. Yeah. His early architectural projects are definitely surface-driven, yeah, facade-driven, internal facade-driven. But he starts to develop more and more of the understanding of a three-dimensional space and is then very able to apply that to a facade. There are things, obviously, like the giant order very clearly comes from the Capitoline. It's got a lot more giant, but it's the same sort of thing that he's doing. He's doing this shifting, using various tricks to shift the scale of columns.
Should we say anything about its afterlife quickly? So that it goes on for like 100 years after this. The kind of presiding designer of the interior is Gian Lorenzo Bernini.
Like the three big people in the project are, if you need to know three people, you need to know Bramante, Michelangelo and Bernini.
Yeah.
Because Bernini does most of the rest of it.
Yeah.
Bernini, I think we would say, is probably talented, but of the dark side.
Yeah, I can't really get on with it.
His
I think
buildings aren't very good.
Yeah, I mean, the inside, in a way, there's not that much to say about it.
It would have been a hell of a lot plainer, yeah, if Michelangelo had been left in charge. Yeah. It would have. I think
if
it would have been
lived another 100 years.
If he'd lived another 100 years, it would have been white and grey on the inside, and the dome probably would have been lower.
Yeah,
and I think he would have fought to not have the nave. The nave becomes, even in his late years, there's a real religious reaction going on. And the nave becomes more important. Central plans are looking a bit pagan. But it would have been interesting.
Yeah, the later life of Michelangelo becomes embroiled in the sort of the beginnings of the Counter-Reformation, basically. This kind of retrenchment and forceful reinstatement of the ethos of Catholicism.
It affects his art, and also through these years, he's himself very interested, becoming very interested in theology.
Signor Riccardo Cazzi, clad in unsuitable black velvet, unconvincingly soft against the scarred skin of his face, watches the dead sluggishly dragging themselves from the earth on the day of judgment. Rising, still half asleep, into the ranks of the saved, or being dragged in paroxysms of despair toward the terrified crowd of the damned, an imperious Christ casts them out. No one smiles on the day of judgment. Neither the raised up, newly clothed in flesh, nor the heavenly host, stern and purposeful. I've been there, he thinks, with a blasphemous smile, sending men forward with one hand and pulling them back with the other, thronged by adoring retainers. The flush of victory washes away all past defeats, like the wounds of the cross, now shrunk to the size of pinpricks. The wounds on his own body, he knows, will never diminish. And even the victories, he remembers, out in the plains of Pavia, never before had he achieved such a burning. He now, meeting the horrified gaze of some luckless sinner, is all too aware they were for nothing. Or worse than that. So much impotent strength he sees before him, bulging muscles. Powerless in the face of God, who can stand firm against eternal damnation? Brother Celesti, in his grey Dominican habit, sees in the bright new fresco a reminder of his growing doubt. Not, of course, in the existence of God, nor in the righteousness of his work, but heaven, or that apostolic church, seem a remoter prospect. As he steps through the screen, he sees Ricky, the sternness of his face melting at the moment of recognition. And then they stand in the autumn sun, in a square filled with the tombs of ancient popes, watching the new church rising over the ruins of the old. Men crawling over the structure, a writhing mass of bodies, rising like the host of the saved towards heaven. Cranes and scaffolding, the cries of banksmen. A huge block, swinging unsteadily as it rises, striking the top of the arch, a shower of dust and raised voices. The creak of wood, straining as it inches above the opening. And then slowly, tentatively, lowered into place. Rumbles, sighs, and stands. Smiles, laughs, a cry of thanks be to God from all around. So the Last Judgment came about as a commission which was originally mooted, I think, in 1534. So it started under the previous pope, Pope Clement.
Who's the Medici who did all the Florence conquering?
The commission was to do a fresco for the end wall above the altar in the Sistine Chapel. And it has quite a long development. In its initial versions, it's a depiction of the resurrection.
For which there are a couple of beautiful drawings.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about those first?
Yeah, why not? I mean,
this is kind of a what if, isn't it?
The most promising one is this, and it feels like a drawing from 100 years later. It feels like something that's done after Caravaggio or something like that, where this body is, Christ has come out of his tomb. He looks just like a normal person, and he's like swirling up into the air like a bit of smoke or something.
Yeah, the tomb is...
And he's in a sort of ecstatic dance.
The tomb is not... You know, often you see the tomb and it's like a big hole in a cliff or something with a rock in front of it. This is like a stone sarcophagus. The lid has popped off. There are people around and he's kind of floating up. He's drawn up, but in this... He's very relaxed. His body is very relaxed.
And it's all twisting up. It's like air dancing. The soul and the body have sort of fused into this light thing. And again, he's done the thing of, making it all archetypical. It's a generic, very impressive tomb, rather than Golgotha. It's not Golgotha. Golgotha's where he's killed. What's it called? Something.
Yeah, wherever it was. But then, I mean, I'm not even sure if that... Is that representation textual, or is it just conventional? They talk about the stone being rolled back
all that happens is the stone's rolled back.
That could just be translation, though. It just means that the stone has been moved.
Well, the stone's been moved. Yeah. Oh, no, that he's resurrected.
No, that the stone is talked about as like a roly boulder thing.
Yeah.
But that's probably translation, isn't it? I don't know what it is in Greek or whatever it's
called. Yeah, no idea.
But maybe one of our listeners knows and they can tell us.
Yeah, one of our listeners. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone been scrubbing up on your Aramaic recently?
You made there's a slight similarity with a depiction of the same scene in Piero della Francesca, although in which you again have a kind of a tomb which Christ is stepping out of. They're only similar in the sense of the type of tomb and also the cast.
Yeah,
but in the Piero della Francesca, people are sleeping, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, and there should be people sleeping.
Yeah, whereas in this one, actually,
They're shocked and awed.
Yeah.
The difference between them is like a classic difference between the High Renaissance and the Baroque, or even the Mannerist. But really, I mean, I would say it's a work that is very much into the Baroque.
The drawing has one of the peculiar features of a lot of Michelangelo's drawings of this period and later, which is that they're bodies without heads. He doesn't draw the faces.
Well, this is always... I mean, we've discussed how it works generally. He works out from the body.
But he often goes...
And often
he
arms often... are sort of flapping around in three different positions in the drawings.
Yeah.
There's basically no head at all.
Yeah.
But the six-pack is resplendent. And the thing right before the head is the upper arm and hands, which are also usually blurred. Yeah. It's partly that they are not as important to him, but it's also that he regards them as having more compositional flexibility. And the drawings are just drafts. He's just composing.
Just to tell the story of the commission, Pope dies, new Pope, in 1536, and also a change of theme, and it's going to be the Last Judgment. So the end of the world, the separating of the virtuous from the wicked, the saved being carried into heaven, and the damned being cast into hell.
Yeah, this is the, like, grumpy revelation bit. Yeah. And it's in a lot of ways, is like a classic doom, but in a lot of ways isn't. it kind of obeys the convention of like hell on the right. But there are changes. It's another one of these packed cast compositions with lots of writhing figures, which he'd done for the Battle in Florence, which has disappeared, the Battle of the Centaurs, various other bits and bobs. But everyone is a person. The angels are just people. Everyone has got rippling, bulging muscles. No one's got wings.
In some ways, the composition is a little bit reminiscent of earlier Renaissance or kind of late medieval wall paintings of the Last Judgment.
Oh, there's another massive obvious difference as well, which is the perspective. So those things, the action normally happens, for the most part, in roughly a plane. Yeah. They'll be painted in three dimensions. Figures are broadly around the same size. Yeah. There'll be some foreshortening. Here, some are tiny and really far in the background, and some are at the front, but it's not in a three-point perspective. There's perspectives going off in all sorts of directions.
Hell is right in the corner. It's interesting. Often, if you look at these, is there the one in San Gimignano? I'm trying to remember. There's a famous one where you see the devil, and it's this great big thing with kind of snaky arms.
And he's got like tentacles coming
and it's not like that. I think it's in Giotto in Padua. But in this one, there's just this kind of flame lit corner. And actually, the horror, like hell, the awfulness of hell is mostly conveyed by the expressions of the people who are going there.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. Yeah. They're not looking happy. But no one's looking happy. No one is happy. Some people are righteous or pointing towards Christ or doing things. Yeah. Some people are drifting up to heaven. Some people are racing up to heaven. Yeah. Many people are being pulled down. But no one is, there's no joy.
No, there's sort of solemn
sorrow.
Purpose. Yeah.
Anguish.
I think for me there's a kind of impassivity. You sense that the people in heaven can hear all the cries of the people going to hell, and they care not a jot.
It's not quite Calvin. Calvin who said, well, I couldn't tell you how many the elect is, but it's probably somewhere between 1 in 20 and 1 in 200. Mm. And heaven is a gallery onto hell. The only thing that's good about heaven is you get to watch everyone be tortured for eternity. It's not quite that.
It's more like they're not listening. And it's,
I think it's a very troubling work.
It's nasty.
It's a very troubling work. Michelangelo, from his mid-period on, is dry and somber. You know, when we're talking about the library or the chapel, they're tomb-like, they're rib-like. They're cold and colourless, which actually isn't necessarily true in the early works, although it's true a bit. This is very solemn. Where's the love, Mickey?
There's not a lot of sign of it. Should we talk about the nudity?
Yeah,
so
I mean,
in the original version, almost everyone was naked. Everyone's naked coming out of the grave.
Makes sense.
But also lots of people in heaven naked.
Yeah.
But broadly...
So Bartholomew's naked and holding his own skin.
Yeah. Yeah, his skin has grown back, though, so he's got two skins now.
Yeah.
Which shows...
Well, everyone's
he's
like...
been rewarded for his martyrdom.
Veiled in flesh.
Yeah.
Well, essentially, there is actually, even at the time that he's painting this, but particularly... I think the Council of Trent is maybe starting around this time, and it goes on for a very long time. Yeah. But we're beginning to get... The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, this is the Counter-Reformation. And there's this forceful restatement of what...
Orthodoxy.
Catholic orthodoxy. And it means cracking down on a lot of things. It means banning a lot of things.
Yeah, and so we're not having any more paganism, specifically. We're not having any more
in
nudity.
Kind of, symbolic paganism. Or
doctrine becomes much more rigid. You know, Pope Julius in the Vatican had a library... which is the Raphael Library. Yeah. And on one side, there's theology. There's one side, there's law. But there's also, like, poetry and philosophy. No. And we're getting into the Jesuit oath of... I can't remember the exact formulation, but basically, if what I see as white, the hierarchical church says is black, it is black.
Yeah, there are other rules. They're no longer allowed to depict anything which isn't in Scripture. I think which actually means
ruining. Yeah, so if you think of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, it's got all sorts of funny stuff that really shouldn't be there. It's got all sorts of sibyls and, you know, people, pagan prophetesses and things. And I think the sort of feeling behind that is these pagan philosophers, they aren't Christianity, but echoes. Yeah. They're part of God's life. They haven't had the truth revealed to them, but they're almost... Dante has, he wants them to be in heaven, but they can't be there.
Yeah, they're all in a nice castle on the edge, aren't they?
Yeah. He wants them to, he can't put them in heaven, but Michelangelo could put them on the edge of the ceiling, porting the columns and stuff. No more.
No. So there's been a cull, and there's also a new mood of kind of prudity, or yeah, prudishness,
which is very funny. I mean, if you want to see the real extreme of this, Bernini. A generation later, the rape of whatever it is. Several of his sculptures are, at one point, massively sexual and hugely more graphic than Michelangelo ever was, but also covered up in all the right places, yeah, in like a completely contrived way.
From the moment of its completion, The Last Judgment was very unpopular among a lot of people in the Vatican and church hierarchy, and also that they spend a lot of time covering up a lot of the genitals.
Yeah. Which they covered up one round, and yeah, then a few years later, they'd be like, I can still see willies.
Yeah, went another go.
And then there's bottoms out.
Yeah, down with the bottoms. Michelangelo's friend, the artist Daniele da Volterra, is sadly remembered to history with the nickname Il Braghettone, meaning the maker of breeches. For his, yes, part in the...
Painting the pants. Painting pants. He was the part of the first generation of pant painters.
Yeah. And in the recent restoration, they left his on.
And quite a few of the other ones on. They left anything on, I think, from roughly before the first half of the 17th century. Right, so yeah, the first 100 years of covering up. Oh, and there's the papal censor.
Oh, yeah. So
he's like in the middle of hell, having his testicles being bitten by a giant snake.
Yeah, so this is the person...
Which tells you, I think, all you need to know about Michelangelo's response to all this.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't having it.
No, he didn't think... I think he thought that the omniscient Lord probably didn't mind.
Yeah, whether your balls were hidden or showing.
Yeah.
Because he can see them either way.
In his early career, he's someone at the cutting edge of his time, pushing it forward. And I think his late style, as you often get in late style, is much more of other times. Later on, we'll discuss work that feel like they're stretching back to the early Renaissance or even the Gothic. Some of this is going forward into the Baroque or even the Romantic.
Yeah.
There's shades of William Blake. In the other drawings, there are shades of more conventional Baroque. There's almost shades of Bernini or Caravaggio.
Yeah.
And later on, there'll be some things which have got very strong elements of modernism.
And it's contradictory.
And it's also contradictory with the architecture. He can at once be the promoter of harmony in St. Peter's. St. Peter's is monolithic, harmonious, and yeah, central. At the same time as being heretical, dynamic. For him, God is one big thing. Yeah. And is immensely important. He goes back and again to Christ. Christ's suffering. Not perhaps the suffering of witnessing Christ's suffering. People are holding him and are sad. Yeah. He is impassive.
Do you want to talk about some of these other late depictions of Christ?
Yeah, we can kind of go on this, but we'll talk about the architectural stuff as well. There is a brief period in the 1550s, 40s, when we have some drawings from him. The drawings are often more compositionally successful than the wall paintings, rather like the sculptures, I think because they're not as ambitious. It's too much. The wall is too big. It has too much going on. It feels like a not totally resolved collage of a number of pieces together. It's a difficult one. Whereas the drawing, this Christ, yeah, it's very harmonious. He's doing other things in the time, other drawings, which are, in a sense you could say, much more conventional. Yeah. Although very fluid.
So a lot of the other late work that exists is incomplete or fragmentary, and all the more intriguing for that. There's a number of unfinished sculptures, and there are also these drawings which you've alluded to. Do you want to talk about the drawing of the crucifixion?
Yeah, there's two.
Yeah.
Three, in fact, I'm remembering now, crucifixions, which are all very late. Yeah. Your comment was they look like Francis Bacon's.
The one I'm thinking of, Christ is on this kind of Y-shaped cross, and he's flanked by two figures, I think by Mary and by someone else. But in this way, which is quite typical, he's had a lot of different thoughts about the face and has tried different things, and in the end has also rubbed them all out. So we're left with this blurred, ambiguously kind of screaming.
But
Jesus,
he's done this so many times. It's not as if he did that. He's not as if he's drawn over it and rubbed it out once in one drawing.
No.
Every late crucifix, faces and forms are blurred.
Yeah. Well, parts of them are blurred. Parts of them are...
Parts are resolved and parts are blurred. It's intentional, I would contest.
It's intentional that it's blurred.
But he's enjoying the blurriness. I think he's reckoning with it. I think it's partly that he's going over it, as you say, rubbing it out.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's just that. He's done it on every single one of them. Maybe I'm wrong.
Mm.
My feeling is that he's trying to communicate something through the sort of... I mean, also, quite kind of obviously, I imagine his sight is going. And his hands are going, and he's a very old man. He's in his 80s, at least.
They're pretty spooky and quite amazing. They're very unsettling to look at, however you interpret what's going on.
Yeah. And there's the same thing with there's three late Pietas, sculptures, which are in various levels of completion. Two of them, one is fairly complete.
One thing to say is that in these late sculptures, the figures have gone back towards these quite thin and graceful physiques of his really early sculpture. They're unlike his mature sculpture, in which the physique is always expressing this kind of power, very highly muscled, very powerful. And they're all, yeah, they've become some, they're very kind of thin, and they express this kind of slumping Christ figure. He's completely limp and...
I mean, in two of them, he's much more muscly and developed. The bodies melt together a lot more. There is the very late one, which is in Milan, which is very clearly not finished. It's got like a hand, an arm that's been knocked off and put back. It's very, you know, you've got this sort of end state of this thing where they're becoming like Gothic figures. In the medium ones, I mean, one of them, slightly oddly, he depicts himself as Joseph. I really don't think you have to psychoanalyze much to say, this is Michelangelo thinking about death.
Yeah.
His death and his relationship with Christ. These weren't really done for anyone else.
No, and actually he destroyed at least one of them deliberately.
Do you mean this one?
That one he...
It's not. That's not...
It just became incomplete. The other one, I think, was smashed to pieces and has actually been reassembled.
Yeah, I think that's the one where he's Joseph. Which
yeah,
isn't this
the
one.
Actually, yeah, the most complete one.
Yeah.
He lost patience with and destroyed, but he consented to allow a friend to take the pieces away. And he subsequently,
such a Michelangelo
he subsequently reassembled them.
Such a Michelangelo thing to smash everything up and then flog it. He was always incredibly parsimonious with cash. So all the while he's thinking about these sort of, you know, divine leanings. He's got an eye to the bottom line.
Do you want to explain what you mean about this connection to Gothic sculpture? Because this idea that he's going in different directions in time now.
Yeah, so you've got the two... I hadn't kind of buffered this up in my brain quite enough. So if of the three Pietas, there's the two earlier ones, one of which has got an incredibly buff Christ. All of them, the proportions of the figures are changing around. Yeah. The one that is most complete is probably the most conventional, but is still very strange. Pietas don't normally have the Christ in a vertical position, which all of them do. The Christ is more similar to the position that he is on the Gothic cross. And like on the Gothic cross, he's quite robust. It's like he's just been taken down, or somehow the cross has become the people.
Everything is very kind of drooping. The clothing that everyone is wearing and their faces and the position of their arms, everything is being kind of drawn down with the weight of the body. in this kind of very drooping, sort of sad, expressive way.
Like the dead body of Christ on the cross, which is slumped.
But it's not. It's different from, you know, if you think of his other sculptures, often there is force which is turned against itself, and there's an expression of, you know, force meeting force.
Well, there's a reason we did all those naughty stories, right? Yeah. Which is because those are sort of about masculine energy, this tension. Here it is about the release of life flowing out, and possibly a very sad sort of redemption.
The strength has gone out of the body.
Yeah, and even, you know, it's taking it the next step on from the crucifix. When you take the nails out, the whole thing flops. And then the last one, the other thing that's gothic about them is that the figures are often becoming elongated and extended, which is a very gothic notion of elegance.
Yeah.
And ethereal elegance, and the innocence and littleness of these figures.
One of the strangest things is in one of them, there's this little angel figure, which is a very medieval kind of intrusion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
He was always aware of medieval sculpture. Also, at this point, he doesn't care. He can do whatever he wants. He can do what he wants. And I think the way the ego has changed, he's no longer really interested in virtuosity in the same way. He's trying to get to truth. And he's got a different sort of energy. I mean, he's working right through till his death.
Yeah.
Working till a few days before he died, aged 88, on one of these. He's doing the same things. He's like smashing up what he's done, reworking, trying to find this truth.
Burning all his drawings.
Yeah, he did get all his drawings together and burn them at the end, which is rather irritating.
Yeah, very sad.
He had a thing with pride.
So he also has some late, and also, it should be said, very partial representations of buildings, which are really just at the concept stage, but which are fascinating for how forward-looking they are and how much they seem to go beyond and anticipate architecture, which is really some distance away still. So should we talk about the Sforza Chapel?
This is the most future-like. It's the most into the Baroque.
Yeah.
It's a small chapel. Again, the site is a square, as in the shape rather than the urban form, as a small side chapel. But instead of doing the sorts of things he would have done earlier on, it's moved out of a central axis. So it's got these two ovoid wings.
It has, one of the things which is strange about it is that there's obviously a sort of diagonal vault over the centre, but the columns have become detached from the walls and are following that diagonal line of force into the centre of the room.
Yeah.
So in a way which is quite unprecedented, really, quite strange. Yeah.
And also, it's sort of central plan, but he's moved the centre out of the centre, and he's moved it forward. So you look forward into a niche, and which is a square one, and you've got elliptical ones on either side. And then the shape is these low, funny domes, and there's a very strange window, which is a really extreme example of the sort of thing that was in the Medici Chapel, but it's become Baroque. All he did for this was he drew up the plan, and I think two sections, and then it was given to other people to do. But they are the bits that are really interesting.
Yeah, the effect is pretty strange, because these columns have kind of come away. They kind of prop up the ends of these vaults.
It's but eerie.
They've become kind of independent. The kind of the forces expressed in the walls and in the columns are dynamic and are kind of moving or in kind of tangential relationships to each other. They're kind of pulling away and around, and everything is shifting. There's another one, which is this chapel, or that was a church project. And this one, I think, is really quite weird. Is a church
which wasn't built at all.
Yeah. Which only exists as a plan, really. Oh, I think maybe someone's
drawn up a section. He did a section as well.
Yeah.
He did many, many versions of the plan.
San Giovanni de Fiorentini, which is a cross-shaped church, but it's been turned 45 degrees so that the portico and the way that you come in is into the crotch of two of the arms, which is makes for quite a strange plan. And then at the end of each of the arms is a little elliptical or sometimes it's a semicircular, sometimes it's an elliptical chapel.
What could be going on in those chapels, Mickey?
I don't know, all kinds of things.
The hiding of forgers?
Yeah, nuns will not be safe, I know that much. It's strange, isn't it? Because you're going to have... It means that the altar is also at the sort of opposite crotch of these arms, and all the chapels are on the 45-degree angles. It feels... It's a little bit like a panopticon or something. All of these lines of...
Well, he's been experimenting with lots of strange central plans. You know, there's like this one.
Oh yeah, which is that one?
It's for the same project.
Oh right, yeah.
And you can see, so this is one which is based on concentric circles, and it has again these really like strange triangular chapels in the corners to, you know, make the circle into a square, and it has a central altar. So he spent quite a long time fiddling around with different configurations of the central plan, trying out different ways of modelling the three dimension to make the single shape more dynamic, I think. Trying out very dynamic models of this three-dimensional mass. I think that's what's going on.
It's interesting that in the chapels, in some of these versions, which are an ellipse which you enter on the short axis, which is going to become a type of church which lots of people are doing, but about 100 years later. So Bernini has one of these at Sant'Andrea, but it's a very, like, it's a stock. This is where the connection to the Baroque is sort of smack you in the face, obvious. It's like, it's a stock Baroque church plan.
Yeah. What he's done is he has, firstly, gone completely 3D, completely three-dimensional, and freed himself from the perfect squares and circles of 100 years before him, so that he can squash them, pull them, do anything he likes to them in three dimensions.
The section of this building would have been a dome. It would have been a Pantheon-like dome in some of the versions. Some of them actually have, as in the Pantheon, an oculus at the top.
And, or a funny combination of, like, cascading, sort of, a single dome, but with many shells for the outer chapels.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he ran out of time. He ran out of time, but it would have been fascinating to see it
develop
further.
If only he'd lived to 160.
Yeah. There was plenty more to do. Well, should we talk about death? Do you want
now,
to talk about death?
This has all been about death, hasn't it? We just talked about...
Death lies... We said at the beginning, but death lies very heavy over all of this work because... Well, I think for a bunch of reasons. Because he was old for such a long time, I think you can't look past that. But also because of what he'd lived through.
Yeah, torrid times. People are dying all over the place. When we talk about death, this is the hardest thing. So the sexuality is quite easy to talk about. We can kind of understand sexuality. It's not much of a step. And we're quite young, and understanding youth is fairly straightforward. It's much harder... I mean, I think I've got some sort of religious sensibilities, but I'm deeply not religious. But to combine having a really deep relationship with Christ and a sense of, if not imminent, then impossibly onrushing death is very difficult. And you were talking about the sort of paradigm of late style, which is something that I kind of codified for myself. If you think of the late works of Rembrandt, or you get, or if I'm sure people will be familiar with watching like old relatives get very old. People deal with it in different ways, but one thing that is quite common is that much of what was important before is no longer important because you're going to die.
Yeah, the kind of the fallacy of late style is that people move towards serenity and resolution, and the reality of late style is that it often expresses complex, contradictory, unresolved, and kind of new aspects.
Yes, people also, there's several things going on. One, there's the worry about death, but also you stop worrying about everyone else, so people get a bit freed up. Which is part of the reason why I think the late Michelangelo is kind of unleashing something that was latent there.
Yeah.
He latently is interested in the past and this freedom. You can see that he's being highly plastic with human form right from the word go, but and also using ambiguity. But that's only really, the brakes are only taken off when it's clear that, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, these would have been all the paintings he was drawing as a naughty schoolboy truanting, aren't they? Yeah, he would have been.
One thing is, yeah, death takes the brakes off because he doesn't matter what everyone else is thinking. And this stuff is very much for him. It was hanging around in his studio quite a lot of it for quite a long time. Yeah. The other side is not only do other people not matter, but what does matter is different. Yeah. And that's something that's harder for me to get into. I can obviously think that you can still have a belief in the sort of goodness of humanity or not. But he seems to be really into it's melancholy. It's much more like late Rembrandt has melancholy moments, but isn't this melancholy? Not even, you know. I mean, there's that one of the Batavians, which is very sad, but there is also lightness, you know. There's also the touching sort of human gestures that he employed. There's little happiness in late
Michelangelo. No, it's severity. There's a lot of kind of...
Even Christ's love is impassive. Even in the Pietas, even when Michelangelo is carrying Christ, he is sad, and you know, Michelangelo is sad, and Christ is dead, impassive, eternally dead. Yeah. And when Christ is resurrected, in Piero and Francesca, he looks straight into your eyes. He is the Lord. He is at the top of a pyramid, which is, you know, got many significances. And he is going straight into your heart and offering you redemption.
Yes.
And stillness and peace in a world of tumult.
Yeah.
It's a painting worth looking at. Michelangelo's resurrection, Christ doesn't even have a face. And if it did, it would be misting up. Like this smoke. He is at the same time being resurrected and becoming light on the mountain. There isn't, you know, you don't have, that isn't a Christ to which doubting Thomas is going to put his hand in the wound, is it?
No, he's off.
And it isn't a Christ that is going to have that conversation with Mary where it's like...
Don't worry.
You don't need to be embarrassed. I know they'll laugh at you, but then they'll see I'm here. It's got none of that, which is so funny because the humanity is still present in the body. He's still interested in the body, but the humanity of, like, the social humanity is really lacking, which I guess we're trying to put back in the story. Like, all these people working together to build St. Peter's is kind of the legacy.
Yeah.
And we kind of offer a resolution in that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure Mickey did.
Well, death comes to us all. And two episodes ago, we met two characters, and like all men, they must die.
Ricardo, unsaved by his momentary insights, struck on the head in pell-mell retreat, his body jerking and falling, the world upside down, darkness rising before his eyes and the sound of roaring.
Aurelio slumping over in the misericord in Vespers, tightness in his chest, mumbling through lines. The breath leaves him, but the words remain. We have to bid them both farewell.
And last but not least,
Michelangelo.
Mickey, having struck the arm off the sculpture, retires, rises. The drop before his eyes falls down, gasping, croaking on the hard stone floor. He struggles, rasps for breath, fails, falters, and sees the light. Yeah. And who is waiting for him?
They're all together.
They're there!
They're all together. They all go to heaven.
Everyone goes to heaven.
What makes someone burn all their drawings? What makes someone...
I think that actually is pride.
Yeah,
which
but it's pride. It's pride in something else, isn't it? I mean, these are the actions of a person swinging wildly between extremes. to work and work and work at this sculpture, and then smash it to pieces. And then to let someone gather up the pieces and take them away, knowing that they're going to put it back together. I think that he swings wildly between moments of what feel like insight and moments of what feel like terror and doubt.
One of the nice social elements of his later life is he would meet people and they would discuss theology together at parties, yeah, you know, or at meetings of people. There's the friendship with whatever she's called.
Yeah, this famous old widow who are, they're very great friends and have a long correspondence about all sorts, yeah, of things.
And would meet and talk. And he and a number of the reason why a number of the drawings survive is because he gave them to her. That is a significant channel, actually, of the drawing surviving. Because also, there isn't an awful lot else going on in his life. He had plenty of money, but he always lived immensely ascetically. Yeah. People describe him in his 70s refusing to sleep in a bed and sleeping on the floor. And how his body was swollen because of this. Definitely never married or gone down that kind of route. No. I don't think there was very much sex going on. If any at all, he does have a bit of society. He does talk to people, but I think he's very, very involved in art and God.
What are these moments to him? What is the Pietà? What is the crucifixion? He returns to them again and again, and I think that the problem of it, the kind of compositional problem of these things, which has been occupying him his entire life, it's part of what's going on, but it's something else as well, isn't it?
This one, which is the one that was smashed up. A thought of mine is, like, right at the beginning, there's him, again, looking at the bodies of dead people, dead men in the hospital. Desire and sadness. I think that's something. It's a bit strange. And, I mean, it's a bit of a leap for me, because I have got nothing to back that up on. But I'm not saying that that moment viewed his life. I'm just saying that there is a moment where his relationship, we sort of made the male sexuality joyous, probably more so than is justified. It just makes it a bit depressing otherwise, because part of the reason he's so angry with Leonardo is that Leonardo is not totally neurotic about his sexuality. I mean, I don't think Leonardo is, you know, Leonardo isn't completely gay or anything, but to the extent that he is sexual, he is prepared to do something about it, whereas Michelangelo I don't think he feels good about it. I'm not sure I can completely psychoanalyze it, but I think some of the sadness is that his relationship with looking at this beauty and youth, yeah, which is part of what the Christs are, yeah, and why he's so interested in them dead. All of this is immensely speculative.
Yeah, it is. That's all right.
You can't, you know, people can argue about it till the cows come home. But there's definitely sadness.
Yeah, he's someone who's driven by powerful emotions, isn't he? And in contradictory directions.
They all are, Luke. All the good ones. Have we talked about anyone who's really good who isn't? Herman, maybe. But,
yeah, know. Herman, I think, had things quite under wraps.
Yeah, yeah. He was pretty chilled out. But I'm not sure we could call him one of the greats either. Aldo or Bruno. Oceanic, because that is the same thing which is hero worship, which is the same thing which is, I mean, not the same, they're not the same thing, but they're the same sort of thing as religion. They're part of that human capacity to worship, or, you know, experience the infinite beyond the self. The way we deal as creatures in time, who can only exist in time, with the infinite is through that emotion, to the extent that it has any meaning. Which you can call lots of things or channel in lots of ways, but that, I mean, that kind of crystallized into buildings is, and the ability to evoke that in buildings is really exciting, and I think is part of what excites us.
It's been a thing we've talked about for a while doing this episode. It's more than any other, it challenges us to talk about form, about the physical effect of buildings, about atmosphere, about the accumulation of a lot of small design decisions which are happening in somewhat abstruse and jargon-filled fields, and how those add up to something which is kind of all-enveloping and profound.
I mean, architecture is always the relationship between people and things, And it's nice that you have a clear, in Michelangelo, there's psychology, process, that leads to these magnificent objects. Which I think is an interesting thing to analyse. It's also so unlike what we do now.
I think it's finished.
Yeah. Well, thanks for...
bearing with us.
Yeah, thanks for going through,
Thanks
for going through it with us. And please get in touch about what you think.
We might be back to the not quite present.
We've got our eye on what we're doing next, and it's something very different. But yes, certainly about the contemporary condition, and potentially easier to laugh about.
Oh, we had some good times in the middle. It's not everything in life is funny. Some things are serious.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, why not recommend it to someone else?
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can tweet about us or tweet at us or all these kinds of things.
We're, review up. That's always nice.
Yeah, we'd like...
only favourable ones, yes, please.
Please, a review on iTunes would be lovely. But yeah, word of mouth, recommendation. Why not recommend us to a relative or a person who...
elderly maiden aunt.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm imagining.
It was the way you were talking about it.
Yeah.
And someone who can't get out of the house as much as they used to.
Yeah, if you are that elderly maiden aunt, why not recommend it to one of your other nieces or nephews?
Yes.
You can always email us at aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com. You can tweet at us at aboutbuildings, I think. I should try and get this right, actually. What's our Twitter?
Yeah, well, we don't make it easy for them. They've got to look it up themselves. I think it is at about buildings.
It's at about underscore buildings.
@about_buildings. So you thought that would like simplify things.
@_buildings, and we're the same thing on Instagram. And our Facebook page, I haven't done anything on for ages.
Yeah, I haven't done anything on any of these.
Yeah. Yeah, but do send us an email. We'd like to hear from you.
It's very nice.
I've actually replied to all the people who've emailed us so far.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I reply in spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. And... see you next time. Think about...
What's the positive message at the end? Don't worry, you don't have to be as good as Michelangelo.
No, you don't have...
It's okay if at the age of 30 you haven't redefined the cultural landscape.
Yeah.
Okay. If you haven't... at the age of 30, if you haven't got, like, the defining works of the Western canon under your belt, don't worry, there's still plenty of time.
Yeah. At least that's what I'm telling myself.
Yeah. Well, Aldo was like any serious man should have started something by the age of 30.
Yes. Well, I'm placing my hopes in the podcast. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.